This is an interview with Mr. N. Yost Osborne, Director of College Libraries and Professor of Bibliography at the Mount Union College in Lawrence, Ohio. Mr. Osborne has been associated with the college for over 40 years. In 1936, he graduated from the college with a Bachelor of Arts degree. From Mount Union, Mr. Osborne went to the University of Pittsburgh, where he earned the Master of Literature degree in 1939. In 1940, Mr. Osborne earned the Bachelor of Library Science degree from Western Reserve University. After graduating from Western Reserve, he returned to Mount Union, where he has been employed in the library since 1940. This interview is being conducted on November 17, 1978, at Mr. Osborne's office in the Mount Union College Library. The interviewer is George W.S. Hayes, head of the Adult Department of Rodman Public Library in Lawrence, Ohio.
Now, Mr. Osborne, would you tell me a little bit about your personal background, like where you were from, and then what influenced you to come to Mount Union?
All right. Well, actually, I come from not very far away, about 60 miles south of here, in the hill part of eastern Ohio, in Harrison County, a little place called Jewett, and I'll spell it J-E-W-E-T-T. Part of it was originally Fairview because of the very fine view around, but when the railroad went through after the Civil War, the vice president's name was Mr. Jewett, so in appreciation, it became Jewett. And I suppose about its only claim to fame, just a little community. I came to college here, and I suppose largely during Depression years, because I got a scholarship, for one thing. And I think secondly, my mother had gone here at the turn of the century, and my father had gone to Sile College, and that's SCIO, which was merged with Mount Union in 1911. That's also, was a small Methodist college. So I had heard and was aware of Mount Union for many, many years. Came here and graduated, went on to Potsdam High School, went on to Pitt in history, and started on a doctorate there. And unfortunately, it was just coming out of the Depression, I wasn't able to go on. The chairman of the history department there, Dr. Oliver, informed me that he had a fine opportunity, a scholarship, three-year scholarship to Western Reserve in history. And at that time, Reserve, as it still is, was very fine in graduate history. I was quite pleased until I learned the terms of the financial aid, which was $100 a year. And even in Depression times, that just didn't cut it. So I informed him of this, and he said, but it's the honor, and you will have to scrape up to eat additional. Well, I just couldn't do that. I was thinking about going back into high school teaching. In fact, I had an opportunity up along the lake by Ashtabula. I was going up to check with them, and I got a phone call. And I always thought it was like the providential ram in the briar that Abraham and Isaac, the years in the Old Testament at that time. Mr. Stauffer, who at that time was a librarian here and professor of classics, called and said he wanted me to stop by. I'd been worked very closely with him when I was in college here. And he indicated he was interested in someone to be his successor. Wondered if I'd be interested and might think of going on in library work. And it was sort of the proverbial out of the blue. I thought about it. In the meantime, I also wanted to get married, so I knew I couldn't do 3 years, but 1 year I mortgaged myself, got married, and went to Western Reserve, as it was known then, and the next year came down here, which was 1940. So after an absence of 4 years, I graduated in 1936, I came back in 1940 and have been here ever since. time out for a little war experience.
Mm-hmm. What was the college like when you first came here as a student? What were the students like?
You mean in 1932 now, when I first came?
As a student.
Well, I came from a small town, and to me, excuse me, this was a giant step. I really thought that, to me, it was quite an opportunity. I enjoyed it very much. As I look back now, the college was provincial. It was a throwback to, well, I suppose, a generation or even a generation beyond that earlier. The leadership primarily was composed of individuals who had deep roots in Mount Union, and it was homogeneous rather than heterogeneous. And I think there are many things to be said on either side. I'm glad I had that experience that way. It was, to me, a very fine experience, and the group of faculty, a small group, but many of them have been here since the early 20s, worked together well, and I think you caught a spirit that you wouldn't maybe on a larger campus where you had a more sophisticated faculty person. The students, this is during Depression, there was scarcely a car on campus. Anyone who had a car was supposed to be related to a millionaire. There were just very, very few. Parking was certainly no problem. Most of the students were poor, middle, lower middle class income bracket.
How large was the school at that
time? Oh, the school roughly around 500 at that time. So in a sense, when I came back in 1936, I came back to an institution that really hadn't changed too much. In the time I'd been gone, there were a few new faculty, but many of the faculty under whom I had had classes, I worked with as colleagues.
What was the curriculum of the college like 40 years ago?
I think it was geared a little more to strictly liberal arts than it is at present, although teacher preparation was certainly a big part of it. There was, and the pre-professional, the law, medicine, and there were more in going into the ministry, pre-ministerial at that time. I think the year I came, as I recall, Latin and Greek, for the first time, were not a requirement. Up to that time, every college student had to take so much, regardless of what one had had in high school, there was still a requirement to take a year or maybe two or more in college, of both often, and certainly one. The year I came, that was relaxed. I often regretted in some respects that I didn't go on, didn't continue, at least in the Greek, I'd had some Latin.
What was the relationship between the college and the community? Was it friendly or?
Oh, at that time, yeah, I suppose you have to base this on what it's like currently or what it was earlier. I think it's a much better relationship today. At that time, there were misgivings in the community because of certain events which had happened years earlier and which carried over. It was nothing really to do with the community. It was just simply that the president of that college, who was at that time the president of the college, was O.N. Hartshorn, who intended to do well, but he used the endowment of the college to speculate in a fashion not to his own personal advantage, but for the advantage of the college, and lost it all in a very celebrated law suit. And as a result, and because of some depression periods that followed, the college almost folded up. It just almost went out of existence. And in 1911, at the time SIL was merged, for people outside this area in the conference, in the Northeast Ohio Conference, there was a speculation whether Mount Union was going to go to SIL or vice versa. And it was just through the coming of a young, energetic president like McMaster and the culmination of the Carnegie Pledge that it stayed here. But the aftermath of that is in the community. And then I think after World War I, Memorial Hall was built, and there was a misapprehension in the community. The college raised funds to build it, but many people in the community maybe only gave a dollar or 50 cents, and there were many, many gifts like that. Felt somehow they had a vested interest in that place, and if they wanted to hold a wedding reception or a dance, it should be available. And what they didn't understand was that although it could be used for certain large convocation purposes, it wasn't a personal, it wasn't a social hall in the sense that many of the lodge halls are. So I think it was a combination of those that items that led to an estrangement of town and gown. And I think that was one of the very skillful accomplishments on the part of President Ketchum. He was able to rekindle this spirit that had once existed, and we have a much better relationship now.
Was there any social life back in the 30s for the students, or was all time spent in studying?
College students are always college students. But as I have been on the scene here for a great many years, I think probably more time was spent in studying. The thing that I notice most that is lacking is reading. I think students did more reading in those days. Maybe students today study as much, but they don't read as much. There certainly weren't the outlets, and that was a cry in those days. I think many times students tended to provide their own amusement. They got up and did their own thing, so to speak, which was not necessarily a beer bash or something of this nature. But I think today, I've noticed that students who come here have more and more feeling that you have to do something for me, you have to entertain me, you have to provide this as well as the standard curriculum and other outlets. Most of what we did was, I think fraternities and sororities were more powerful in those days and more a part of the whole campus life. And you really, individuals who didn't belong were not exactly ostracized, but people who wanted to be on the swim of things belonged to one of the organizations. And usually weekends, other times there were opportunities they afforded. So this took care of a lot of the social outlets. I think during the week, there was a law, of course, but it was just unheard of, that students would have parties, anything social scheduled. That was just taboo, period, which does not exist today.
You went to prison Tuesday night.
No, it's, you know, as some students indicate, they just get recovered from the weekend, and then it's Tuesday and Wednesday, and it's time for the weekend again, and this is kind of the perennial circle that goes on.
You mentioned fraternities. You were in a fraternity, weren't you?
Yes, I belonged to Alpha Omega when I was on campus, and that time there were five fraternities on campus, and a pretty wholesome competition among them. Fraternities changed over the years, and the system recently, I think the emphasis on fraternities has changed, so that fraternities and sororities today just do not have the influence that they had at one time.
I know when I went to school here, the ATOs did not have a very good image. What was it like when you were in the
family? Well, I have to admit, it was not the greatest at times. I recall the Dean of Women at that time, who was a very subtle sort of individual, a real scholar. She taught history here, too. Used to appear in chapel occasionally. All faculty had to appear during the year for a program, maybe oftener. And chapel was every morning, five times a week. And I recall so well Dean Stevenson getting up and saying, "Ladies and gentlemen," then she'd pause and she'd say, "and ATOs." So there was, I think, somewhat of a stigma, although I don't think it was quite as, they weren't regarded as the animals or the barbarians as they are today. We certainly had some individuals who did their own thing, but there were others who, I think, compensated for that. As I said, fraternities change over the years.
That's interesting. Well, let's jump ahead now to today and see, in your opinion, what is the academic life like now? Is it more complex or more rigorous, or is it too relaxed? How has it changed in 40 years?
We just had a debate. We had a specially called faculty meeting this morning considering what kind of calendar the college would adopt. We presently are on a three-term. The proposal was to continue that or to drop that and take up an early semester, which would be a two-semester school year. And there were very strong feelings expressed for each side. I think it was a foregone conclusion that the majority of the students, preponderance of the students, favored the three-term, and that by about the same percentage, faculty also. Although even the adherents of the three-term current admitted there would have to be some investigation after the vote regardless, and if it were, say, continuation of three-term, there would have to be some investigation of what could be done to improve academic excellence. There was a feeling that the Wednesday problem is one. The weekend exodus is another. And in this sense, I'd have to point out that, of course, being a college historian, I suppose I'm more aware. But Dean Bowman, who was the great venerated dean of the institution from all around World War I through the 1930s, in the 1920s, in an annual report, in fact, two or three annual reports pointed out, one of the main problems with the college was the academic excellence. And number two was the suitcase college, he called it. That students went away on Friday afternoon at 3, didn't get in until Monday morning at 7:30 class, it was then. And he felt that this mitigated against the sort of collegiality that he would like to have on the campus, this spirit. I think in view of what Harvard has done to try to have a core curriculum, or in other words, a body of knowledge that all students must possess or be aware of, regardless of your major, I think we'll probably move toward that. There was talk of a curriculum revision. As I indicated earlier, I think somehow more emphasis upon a reading background. So if one majors in biology, at least he's aware of Chaucer and Milton and Spencer, more than just names, and vice versa. How to do this, I've talked to many students. They admit if there were a requirement for graduation, that they had to read so many books, had to indicate some competence in this background, they'd read it. Otherwise, they'll just bypass this. And I think if we're going to have a liberal arts education, if it's going to be truly liberating, then you must have some cross-the-board education. You can't just be a narrow specialist.
Do the students not take the coursework as seriously as they used to?
Oh, I think many of our students do. I think we have very fine, a group of very fine students, but I think that's the reason they come here, is to have their sights elevated, and if we're liberal arts, you try to liberate them from thinking that 5 minutes of television at night is going to give them all the news that's happening in the world that day. We just have to do more at this point, that's all. I've felt for a long time that many of our graduates who go out are very finely prepared in their own subject major field, but they have to compete with students in other, in the particular business or profession they're in, who not only excel in that, but who have this background. And this separates the sheep from the goats in a herd. And I some of our students, you know, play catch-up. You have to read. You have to discover, well, Picasso was a painter, or Bach was a great composer, and all the other variations like that, which many of our students don't take seriously. They're just not forced to. And I think somewhere we have to insist upon this type of confidence.
It's the best reason I've heard for liberal arts college ever. It makes a lot of sense. What was the library like? Where was the library and what was it composed of when you first came here, and how had it developed up to the point where you came?
The library was over in Chapman Hall. It occupied, I believe, with the exception of the classroom, right at the rear here would be the northeast corner, except that classroom. The library by that time had taken over all the first floor of Chapman Hall. The reading room was across the west side. Offices were across there on the east. And in the basement, what we could utilize of it was our large stack area. There were about 2,000, 3,000 volumes in the reading room upstairs, and some bound magazines in a little anteroom. And then everything else was downstairs. Bound volumes, government documents, and the book collection. Mr. Stauffer was a librarian. He had been librarian since 1920. And I might interject parenthetically that I think it's unique in an institution like this for a period of, say, from 1920 to 1978, which is 58 years, to have only two librarians. This is unique. I can see that it has great virtue because you have a continuity of a policy. Policies are good. On the other hand, I can see it can be disastrous, too. Maybe if you have more people in, you have greater input. So I must make that observation. But the library was in Chapman Hall, and it was recognized, of course, that the quarters were inadequate. Chapman Hall was, they had their own boiler system, and every time they put in a load of coal, I went down with a couple of students with a sweeper and a broom and swept up all the coal dust. It just filtered through. The buffer between the boiler room and the coal cellar there and the rest of the collection was the government documents, because they were considered expendable, and then the rest of the collection on further out, the bound volumes and then the regular books. But it was just impossible. And Mr. Stauffer, of course, deserves a great vote of thanks for what he put up with and what he tried to do under those circumstances. The library, other institutions had a library from the time they were founded, and I think here there was one. It didn't amount to much. In the literary societies from, say, 1850 to 1900, occupied much the position politically on the campus that fraternities and sororities then later did for about 50 years. And they each had a library. The students would use, if you belong to the Linnean, you use that. If you belong to the Republican, if your library didn't contain a volume, you got a friend from the other library. And of course, there was no selection. It's just pretty much what some minister or somebody would give them. They had a lot of anti-slavery propaganda, a lot of anti-Mormon propaganda, and the great works of authors as someone would present them. They had no money to buy with. The libraries were open a half hour in an afternoon. This was about it. When President Marsh came in 1889, he was, a breath of air from the outside. It's kind of like Pope John. He opened the windows. And he decided we must have a library. The literary societies were on their last legs, and he got them to merge, put their libraries together, and that started the college library. But although they had it in name, in fact, they didn't have money to buy works. $200, $300 a year to buy materials, that's all they had for many years. And I think when Mr. Stauffer came in 1920, he threw two-thirds of the library out. It just didn't amount to anything. So in effect, the library almost dates from 1920 when he came. He was a fine scholar. He was a classicist. He taught literature here. very discriminating, very insistent upon standards. I had classes under him and worked in the library for him when I was here. And I hope I tried to carry out that kind of policy as far as selection for the library is concerned. So, after the war, when Dr. King was chairman of the board of trustees and with Dr. Ketchum had sort of swung around the whole concept of support for the institution here, this is what Alliance did, Alliance and Sebring, this area. They provided funds for this library that we presently have. And that was a tremendous step forward to move into this. I said it was kind of moving from the Victorian era to the 20th century just overnight.
When was the present building built?
We moved in here in the fall of 1950. We started in 49, we moved in here in 1950. Actually, we had we gave a day off, an afternoon off, one time in October in 1950, and we had plotted this, planned it all out ahead of time. We had sort of a human conveyor, a student conveyor belt, and we had a tub of donuts and cans of cider out for that Buckeye tree is in a circle there, had that around, and it was a beautiful afternoon, and we had students in our student assistants, well, much like you were when we did the renovation, you know, it was this type of thing. We had a lot of fine student assistants, and we just pointed the students. They started over there with an armload of books and came over here, someone told them where to put it, and we moved, oh, I suppose, 60,000-70,000 volumes that afternoon, which was a good day's work, afternoon's work.
What was the, I don't know if this is going to make any sense, the major type of service that the library provided when you first came here to work? Has it changed over 40 years?
Well, I suppose we just have more reference or more background facilities that we offer, and we do much more in the way of interlibrary loan than we did in those years. I think we did practically zero interlibrary loan in those years. We do much, much more now. And collection-wise, we couldn't do quite so much for the student as we do now. We have much more in the way of resources. I think the second thing is a matter of, well, facility-wise, you'd have to see some way. You can imagine going over to Memorial Hall, what that's like. That's rather stark. But if you just put some long tables and some rough chairs on the floor down there, this is what the library was like. It was just wooden tables, wooden chairs, rather bare. And the Chapman Hall, before it was renovated, was rather dark and gloomy. And the hours, when I first came, we were open from 8:30 till 5, we closed. We opened two nights a week from 6:30 to 8 o'clock, Tuesday and Thursday nights, that's all. No weekends. I think Saturday noon, we were open till Saturday, till 12 o'clock Saturday, and then we closed till Monday morning. So we were closed weekends. And just an hour and a half, two evenings a week. And of course, we've amplified that. We're not only open weekends, but we're open till 11 o'clock. Monday through Thursday, or Sunday through Thursday, and Friday till 9, and until 5 on Saturday. So the number of hours is more than doubled at that time.
So accessibility has been increased.
Much, much better.
You had mentioned that the book budget at one time was only about $200 to $300.
That would be turn of the century and up through World War I. When I came, I'd have to look to see what the book budget was. We spend about $50,000 for books now, and we spend over $30,000 for periodicals. And I think when I came, periodicals were maybe like $3,000 was all we spent. We spend $3,700 for 10 abstracts alone right now. We spend more for that than we had the whole periodical budget in 1940, which is inflation and, of course, the great expansion, the breakthrough in the sciences, in the knowledge explosion.
just the tremendous cost of books
right.
themselves.
That's right.
Like last year, the average cost for a book was $18 or something.
Yes. You know, I used to feel that for a novel, I would not want to pay more than $2.50 or $3, and now you're thinking in terms of $10 minimum almost for, and more than that, $12.50, $15 for novels.
For the good ones.
You know, well, for the bad ones, as far as that's concerned.
How big was the staff at the library when you first started here?
Well, let's see, there was Mr. Stauffer, who was the librarian, but he taught classics also, which meant he had a couple classes in Greek. He taught a class in bibliography. We had two. He taught one, and I taught one. And we had a cataloger, Mrs. Angle, and we had a lady who worked, Lilla Patterson. And that was the staff, and I think the second year I was here, Miss Patterson was up in years, decided to go to Florida, and then, as they do now, you know, you just double and brash. She went, so I did everything she did, in addition to what I was doing for the 3 or 4 months that she was gone that time.
What was your, what were your duties when you first came?
Oh, when I first came, it's really a little bit of everything, and that's what intrigued me about coming here, and secondly, about staying on, because you can do a little bit of everything. I remember I had charge of government documents. We're a depository, a selective depository. And Mr. Stauffer took me to one of the office rooms in Chapman Hall, and he said, there are some documents in here that you should catch up on. He opened the door, and it was just like a flood. You know, I don't know if you know Fibber's clothes press or not, but this is what it'll remind you of. There was just box after box after box of documents that had never been opened even. That was one of my duties. It took me a year and a half to catch up with that, to do it. Then it was mainly just operating the desk. Reference work, circulation. I taught a class. We were on semesters at that time, and elementary bibliography was required, so I had two sections, which meant about 40, 50 students a semester in that. And it was just a general assistance, anything that needed to be done.
You mentioned the teaching the bibliography class. You've done that almost every year since you've been here.
Yes, I have. We offer just fall and winter term now, and to a very, very selective. In fact, I have two students. I have two students this term. I have two students who signed up for the next term, winter term. It does winnow out if you have just a few, at least a very interested, motivated students. I used to have, as I say, 20 or more in a section. But I have, by that, virtue of that, been a member of the faculty, and I think whether I had taught or not probably would have had the courtesy of being considered a member of the faculty and going to faculty meetings. This does not apply to the rest of the staff, but it does, by virtue of the fact that I have taught.
Have you taught anything else here besides the bibliography type course?
Yes, during the war years, we got into, of course, an enrollment problem with young men being drafted, and well, there were a few women, but preponderantly it was the men who were taken. I taught some composition, English courses, some composition for 2 years, and when the Air Force was here with the cadet program. I taught, in fact, I taught full-time in that. And then over the years, not so much recently, because Dr. Chapman's been able, I think, to work it out much better. But we had an individual who had some problems, and he term would start, he'd have to be off. He had a drinking problem, and I helped out a couple times with that. We had a couple other young instructors in English, and the same thing happened. They had emotional or problems, physical health problems, and I helped out with that. And in history, Dr. Saff and I offered, we offered an oral history program about 5-6 summers ago to start it, but we just had one taker during the summer, and it was not offered during the regular year. We have thought perhaps this might be a very interesting course for some students to pursue, something about the industrial background of Alliance and in connection with a seminar in history or a culminating experience for a senior. Or do the pottery business in East Liverpool, which is nearby, something of that sort.
I know a number of your students that have taken your courses have gone into library work, myself included. What do you try and teach them in this, probably the very first introduction to library work?
Well, we call the course Elementary Bibliography, and over the years, since we moved into this building the last 25 years or so, I try to make it a combination course, two-thirds of it probably, a basic survey of reference works in the library so that a student can go anywhere and be equipped to do some basic research, elementary to start off with. Secondly, a part of the course, a third of the course maybe, in book selection. Just being able in another course, if a reading assignment is offered, to pick out the best book. Or for a personal library, to pick out those books which will enhance a personal library. And then there's another factor, and I think comes under the appreciation of books. And we're fortunate in having a rare book collection, as we do here. So I utilize that, try to expose students to old manuscripts, old rare books, and current items that are typographically outstanding, so that they have a little appreciation from an aesthetic or art approach of what the book can be. So try to put all that together, and really it's a half course is what it amounts to. As you know, when you took it, you can elect for a full course. In that case, a student does a spatial project, usually something in bibliography or cataloging a spatial part of the collection, something of that sort. Michelle Popa just finished just a year ago, and did a survey of items in the Alliance Room, an annotated bibliography like that. You did one on Canada, so you probably make something that will be a rather practical application.
I'm glad you mentioned the rare book there. It wouldn't be fair to interview you at all without mentioning that. That's one of your biggest joys, hasn't it?
I've enjoyed that, and like Bishop Henderson reminded Charles Ketchum one time at a convocation, he said, "Charles, it takes money to make the mayor run." And anyone who comes in the country knows what that meant. And I have to interject here, I had a secretary throughout my present one. So 3 or 4 years ago, I was writing to an alumnus, and I was recalling this, and I said, I recall this statement, "It takes money to make the mayor run." And my secretary, not being from the country, spelled it M-A-Y-O-R. So I just let it go because it takes money to make mayors run, and it's 70th today too. But no, it takes money to do that. We had the nucleus of a collection, of the classics collection, the Southern classical collection. But Mr. Schultz really gave hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we were able to buy at a time when the rare book market, when you could buy books for reasonable prices. Today, you just wouldn't be able to touch. Many of those items have just appreciated from, the $35, $40 I spent to maybe $200 a piece today. They've gone up like that. But I feel that for this type of institution, we have a fine collection of rare books illustrating what we call calligraphy and typography, what man has excelled in the history in writing and in printing. We have some very fine examples to illustrate that. My only lament is that we have no angels to continue that. And when the college is in a campaign spring through the 80s and wants to match the Timken grant, you can't go out to people and twist your arms further for this. It has to be someone special who has an interest in, who said, if I can't give you this, I'll give it to Harvard or Walsh or someplace else, so that we're almost forced. In fact, this is what Mr. Schultz indicated. We didn't take the money and use it for that. He would simply have given it to Western Reserve Academy, as you know he did there, and to a couple other places in which he was interested.
I forgot to find out beforehand, when did you actually become director of the college libraries?
I came here in 40 and had about 3 years out in service and served as assistant or associate librarian until 1955. Became director of the library when Mr. Stauffer retired at that time. So since 55, I've been director.
There are more than the main library on this campus, right?
We do have two branch libraries. We have a library at Cope Music Hall, and we do have a library at Wilson Hall, the Science Library. And this poses many problems, and I don't know any place can resolve it. Even a place like Ohio State that has, will probably have more volumes in a science library, more staff there than we have here, because there's always an overlap, but the volume someone wants in the main library is at the branch. But basically, the rule of thumb we go by, something on composition, harmony, examples of Bach sonatas, which we just received, we'll go down to Cope. A life of Bach or Beethoven will remain here because we assume many other students will be interested in that. In harmony or counterpoint, that should go to Cope because just music majors. And the same thing at the Wilson Science Library. The more technical and laboratory manuals should go down there. But something on the whole origin of the universe, a book like that will stay here. But something explaining quantum mechanics with a highly mathematical involvement will go down to Wilson Hall.
Now this building has been expanded in the last few years.
Yes, in 1974 we looked ahead to do something about it. In 1975 we dedicated an addition and the rest of the building was renovated, and you were through a part of that and contributed to that, so you know what was involved in all of that. It's bad enough to build a library across campus and to move the collection, but to renovate a building and try to keep the collection going in one part while you're building or renovating in the other part is really something. It's a type of project where you're glad to look back upon and not ahead to anticipate. But thanks to you and who was there? Mark Haydick and
Paul
and John Case, a group of fellows like that. We had a good group to move the books and to do this. We just couldn't accomplish it without. It takes that. So but it's worth putting up with because it's, I think, enhanced the main library, and the addition has been something that we needed. The decor, the decoration, the air conditioning, and I think students have received this quite well. It's instead of the two old study rooms we had, we spread students out now. And, at least to date, all the comments I have had have been very favorable. They seem to appreciate that.
I've heard people from the community say that it's remarkable that the addition blends in so well.
Yeah, this is one thing. I think that's credit to the architects that they were able to do that so that you don't have this, that something is added on.
Has student use increased because the library is a much warmer atmosphere now?
No, I don't think that we, not a tremendous jump. We'll have to wait this fall. We notice we have more students using the library than, say, a year ago. I don't know how that will be reflected. seemingly, this group of freshmen are a little more serious, a little more studious. It's rubbed off on, well, they had a nucleus of upperclassmen. So I think we've had more students who have used the library this fall than we've had for a long, long time.
That's a comforting sign, isn't it?
In fact, until I went in the, well, to the war, World War II, the end of the 30s there, I think circulation-wise, for what those figures mean, we did more business, we had more business, more books circulated per student, three times as many as we have currently. I remember Charles Ketchum, who was president, used to tell me, you wait till you get that new facility, you're just practically going to have to lock the doors to keep students out, you're going to be so full. Well, it didn't turn out. We did have a number. Of course, once we got the student center, that dropped off because many students were using this as sort of a quasi meeting place, socializing spot. But no, I think Mr. Stauffer was disappointed when he first came here about with student use of the library. I have been over the years. I felt that with the facilities we have never had students use that as the term you shouldn't use. They have never maximized it. That's a good educational term. They never made as full a use as they could or should. How you get at that, and that's tied up with the whole reading bit. We ought to have more. Just an aside, when I first came here, I used to have practically 24 students who would come in once a week or once every 2 weeks to talk about their reading. They were reading the bestseller type, and they would say, now this is an investment in time, I don't want to read a potboiler. What do you recommend that really is a good non-fiction or a work of fiction? Then they want to talk about it afterwards. But it's no good to read something if you can't sort of give and take share on it. And I used to have, I went in the service when I came back, that just didn't pick up, and it's not done that since. Once in a while, a student. Not, it seemed to me that was sort of a golden period as far as use of the library and reading is concerned.
It was basically the same problem in the public
library. Right.
I was just talking with the library this morning, and she laments the fact that she can't find anyone to talk to.
Yes.
Nobody's reading, and
yes.
She's greatly disappointed.
We find this on campus with a student who is serious and who wants to read, almost tends to hide the fact for fear that there's not exactly the ostracized, but this is not the end thing to do. Some of the students say they wish they had someone they could sort of share, talk over this book with.
Well, it'd be nice to see the students use this facility more. I remember when I was here working at the desk, a senior came in who had never been in the library before. Was in his second or last term and was being forced to do a paper.
Yeah.
Had never set foot in this building, and it just amazed me how you could go through college and never use the library.
Well, it still happens. And for that matter, we have faculty people too. If they had to give an affidavit when they had last been in the library and collect money, wouldn't collect very much. There are some who just don't. But whatever comfort it is, this is true in many other campuses. It isn't just true here. Some have a little better success, and this is what we hope for, that we could join that group if we have just a little better success student and faculty-wise. On the other hand, we do have some very loyal supporters, someone like Dr. Chapman, Dr. Saffel, Dr. Rodden, people like this, Dr. Phelps, very fine supporters, users.
Well, the national swing seems to be getting back to a more basic curriculum.
Yes, I hope this will be reflected. Certainly do.
What do you see as the role of any college library on any college campus?
Well, I think the function of the library is to support the curriculum, the teaching that is, and whatever research there might be that is going on. We try to do that, and we try to get the periodicals that are going to back up the teaching, plus the books, and of course, no institution can provide all this background. You have to depend on others. Even Ohio State has to interlibrary loan from Penn State or someplace else. So we try to do that. I presume in the very near future, there'll be more of a computerized emphasis and aspect to the libraries. And I guess I'm old-fashioned. I take a very jaundiced view of that. I can't see that solves really problems. Basically, the student still has to read and assimilate and be able to write. And no matter if you can punch a button and find all of this, still a student has to do something with it. If we have three fine definitive texts or books here in a 10-week term, this is about all a competent student can do, is to use three good texts like that to write a paper. If you have 300, what do you do with 300? We just don't have time. And students, most of them, don't have the background to weigh these books to look through them. So I think the computer for large universities where they're doing highly specialized research, maybe for seniors who are doing some sort of spatial project here, this might be of some advantage, but it's still, this is basic type of instruction that students are doing. Once they get this, they can go to the university and then utilize that.
Now, I know you do most of the selection of materials for this library. Isn't it imperative that you've got to have outside advice from the faculty?
Well, some faculty, I mentioned some individuals, some faculty are very good. They assist in this. And, of course, I do send a great deal around to faculty for advice. For science people, because I can't make a judgment, and it becomes very technical. In the field of English, history, and psychology, I can hazard a guess, and you become acquainted with authorities in these areas. You have to have that. I think Mr. Stauffer tended to do that, and I followed along in that pattern. What someone else will do, I don't know whether he can get more faculty involvement. The dean and I have talked about it, but I don't know how you do this with some people. This is a problem. But you're right, it is a real problem. You need more faculty involvement. The questions. In fact, I devised a little experiment project. We were going to try to get funding on it just to accomplish this very thing. But two-thirds of the faculty turned this down. I don't know for what reason, but this was, it seemed to me, an indication. What we were trying to do is have the faculty examine the collection as it pertained to their particular area, define what was antiquated, out of date, what we needed, and then we were going to draw up a proposal to foundations to try to fund this. Well, it's a matter of mechanics, you see, of surveying this, finding what we are weak in, what we could do without, and putting down those things that we need. Most of them felt they were too busy. I proposed they take a senior student and instead of a culminating experience, charge this off as a culminating experience. Many of them felt they would not have a senior equipped to do it and one thing and another, so we never got off the ground on it.
That's too many.
But many faculty are interested, and some faculty hold classes in the library, small, upper-level classes, in the library where they can go right to a section and draw out the books and talk about them.
Do you invite or welcome people from outside the college to come to the library to just tour it or use the facilities here?
Yeah, I just had a call. In fact, on that slip there, I was out this morning. A call came in from a lady who was doing genealogy, and this is, I get five or six of these a week usually. But I explained to her the basic rules, that this is a private, it's for students. We'd be glad to have her and her husband come in and use the facilities. Charging amounts, another thing. And I've become very, very stringent about outsiders to take works out occasionally. And of course, as you know, we cooperate very, very much with Rodman. And we appreciate this relationship. And we like to think that if someone comes in and wants a bestseller, a novel, something that we're not going to get, but that you have to, we can refer that person there. By the same token, if someone down there is interested in who was Shakespeare and you're limited in that, they can come up here and find resources here that they can use. So I think this has been good over the years. The last 10, 15 years, we've tried to, you know, be very cooperative in that respect.
Well, it's good for each other and it's good for the community as a whole.
It is. But I think that's worked out quite well.
Well, I don't think I have any more questions. Is there anything more you'd like to add?
No, I don't think of anything along those lines. I think that's covered a lot of years and a lot of topics. I think it's been a very enjoyable experience. I like the different aspects. I suppose one facet probably didn't touch upon was the matter of archives or historical collection. And in a sense, I sort of inherited that when I came here. I remember that Herman Carr, the business manager, had been interested. His father before him, I think his father was in the second graduating class and was a financial agent for the college. And Herman was business manager for many years. And through this family background, I remember there was a cardboard carton and a bushel basket full of pictures and programs, and that was the historical collection. And we kept it in an old, like, clothes press or a little closet over at Chapman Hall. And one day I became aware of the fact that a trustee came in and was helping himself. Someone had written to him, and he was coming in and taking out a program, was going to send it to that person. And I checked with Mr. Stauffer about the propriety of that, and he said, well, I hate to say anything because it was a trustee. So we devised a system that we locked that, and I was put in charge, and anyone would have to give me a bad time to get something out of it, and I, in turn, would have to say Mr. Stauffer would have to consider it. And from that, we developed a collection of historical materials, and in fact, we have a whole, you know, whole area upstairs now, which is devoted just to that. And I think this reflects the heritage and background of this institution.
Is it all college history, or do you have other areas?
Yes, it's, I suppose there are three divisions in there. We have items that pertain to the college from the very beginning down to the current, right to the present. We also have a section we call MH for any alumnus, former student, or faculty member who writes a book. We try to put one copy in what we call that Mount Union Historical Collection. And then recently, in the last, I suppose, 5 or 10 years, I've developed a spatial, I call it an O collection. It's a local history, and it includes all of Ohio, with spatial emphasis on Alliance and Stark County, this area around here. So I've tried to buy up all the county histories for Ohio and many of the other, the centennial, the bicentennial, rather, brought out a lot of flood histories, and I've tried to buy as many of those as I could. So hopefully sometime some student will want to do something in history or want to do something in local history, will have a lot of background material to operate from. But actually, this person this morning called up. Yesterday I had another letter from a person who wanted some information, a lady in the state of Washington who wanted some information that I had a Xerox from one of the books in that collection. And, there's not a week goes by that there's not at least 3 or 4 inquiries that I use that.
Mm-hmm.